Welcome to the Big 60s Sort Out, brought to you by the Big Beatles Sort Out. We've spent three series sorting the Beatles, and now we're turning our attention to the competition, the context, the bigger picture. Who were they up against? What music influenced them? And will we hear the shockwaves of the Beatles' epic success as we sort all the UK number ones from the 1960s by ranking them for music, lyrics and production? Thanks for joining us as we try and sort out the 60s. Welcome to Series 4, Episode 13. I'm Gary Abbott, author, musician and podcaster, and please welcome my popular music history expert brother, Paul Abbott.
Hello everyone, and hello Gary.
Hello Paul.
That was much more professional, wasn't it?
Yes, well, I think we've got that bit down. Oh, yeah. But I think we might have just ruined it.
Oh no.
Oh, dear. Never mind.
It got away from us again.
I'll do the bumf. Please keep in touch with us on Twitter and Instagram at @big_sort or email us at bigbeatlesortout@gmail.com. And please, if you will, also like and subscribe our show if you can on whatever social media and platforms you choose to use. And please consider dropping by our Bandcamp links that are on the episode description. By now, actually, I'm forgetting that we're a few weeks in the future. You may even have my album. If my new album's out, then you'll see it on the link. But I'll tell you for sure when it definitely is. Okay. I know it's hard.
Wow,
isn't it?
That's hard sell.
This is the slick marketing side of me coming out. Yeah. So, Paul, we're on to the end of 1962, aren't we? This episode.
We seem to have flown through this, but by virtue of it only having enough songs to fill three episodes, and then we've done 1962.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of ones that were there hung around for a while, isn't there?
So, yeah.
And we're going to get some more of that, I guess, as we go through a certain era.
Yeah.
So, which we're getting very close to, aren't we?
Well, yeah, although, as we've said, you know, we have something like The Shadows spending 8 weeks at the top, and that's a record, so it's not like we've got any big, huge blocks of time for many of the things coming up. It's just that there's more. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely going to change. We will see, within a few episodes' time, a notable change in the type of things that are in the charts and how often we're getting something new.
Mm. Yes.
As opposed to legacy.
Interesting. I'm almost kind of like tingling with anticipation of the fact that we are getting towards 1963 and all that brings with it. But in more contemporary times, is anything going on? I've just actual genuine question. I've not seen anything Beatley in the news that I can think of.
Nothing particularly, I don't think, this past week or so. There was some stuff about the auction that is going on of Omega Auctions doing a thing which has a load of cassettes that Ringo made while they were on tour.
All right.
I think Eggpod just did an emergency podcast about it. In fact, I know he did because I listened to it. And that's interesting. It's like, so there's a bunch of tapes that Ringo made while they were on tour over in Manila and in Japan and stuff like that. And obviously they played a couple of little clips because they're advertising them for this auction. And it's another one of those things. It's like, what's on there? You want to hear that sort of Beatles eye perspective on things, even if it's just them being silly to entertain themselves whilst they're locked down in these, you know, hotel rooms. Yeah. I think that's interesting.
So there's tapes of that Ringo made, but we'll be featuring all of them as
because there's like clips. They played a clip where Paul's talking about how their shows and their songs are short and that's what they like and stuff like that. Which is interesting, but I'm sure there's all sorts of little nuggets hidden away there.
I think it was on the Eggpod, the last Eggpod I listened to, when they were looking at the footage from the brothers who did all the...
Oh, the Maisels brothers.
Yeah.
They
were talking, one of the bits of that was about a scene where, I say a scene, some of the footage where they were being shown kind of portable tape recorders and getting quite excited about the technology.
Yeah, I mean, they were very, very excited about technology, cameras and video cameras and so these are proper cassette tapes as we know them, you know. It's very portable compared to what you otherwise would have had to take around with you, you know, reels of tape and stuff.
A small team of scientists.
Yes.
And a portable lab.
And, you know, you could only operate it whilst wearing a lab coat.
Exactly. Which is quite in keeping with some things we're going to be talking about this week, isn't it? Production, especially.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I suppose, Paul, we should think about what the Beatles were up to at this point then, shouldn't we? And
Yes.
Yeah. So we're talking about September to December 1962.
Yeah, how did the Beatles close out their year? And as we know, the story of 1962 has been the getting rid of Pete Best, the acquiring of Ringo, mm-hmm. the getting of a record deal.
Yes, that was all last week.
Yeah,
busy week.
Essentially. I mean, busy week, busy year.
Yeah.
So I've got basically here a very basic list of things through to the end of the year for the Beatles, which is mainly gigs, obviously, because that's what they're doing. But what I think is really interesting about looking at a list of gigs for the Beatles at this point, a band that are about to become a mega smash in the coming weeks and months, mm-hmm. post what we're talking about, they're still such a northern group. We've only had them in essentially Hamburg, one or two places outside of the Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
But mainly, I look down the list here, Liverpool, Chester, New Brighton, Northwich, Liverpool, Widnes, Liverpool, New Brighton, Birkenhead, Liverpool, Heswall, Liverpool, Manchester. You know, Manchester's an out-of-town gig for them, essentially.
Yeah.
But then you get things like the 5th of October, they're in Nuneaton, which is a bit further away, but that's not close, that much further away.
Kind of crew Nuneaton way, isn't it?
Yeah, they're sort of getting out a little bit, but not that far away. Mm. And that's the day that Love Me Do comes out.
Ah.
You know, and where better to be when you release your first record than Nuneaton?
So is Love Me Do, when did that come out?
5th of October, 1962.
Oh, yes, because I'm forgetting. They don't explode until 1963, but they are. They do.
Yeah, this is the start of them. So this is them. A band with a release, you know, that excitement that they talk about of having your music on.
Boys,
a thing.
You're going to Nuneaton. Top of the poppermost. Nothing wrong with the Nuneaton. It's one of those, I think I skirt around the edges of it when I go to certain nice places in that kind of, that side.
Is skirting around Nuneaton a euphemism for something?
Who knows?
Yeah, but that's what, you know, Love Me Do comes out on the 5th of October 1962. And it's not like if you read the stories or, you know, the histories of them at that point, it's not like there's a big party or, you know, fireworks going off anywhere. They're off to Nuneaton to play the Cooperative Hall.
Yeah.
You know, but like I say, these are all Northwest or Northwest-ish. You know, Port Sunlight again, Liverpool. Then they're playing New Brighton, where the headliner on the 12th of October 1962 is Little Richard.
Right.
And who do we have in Little Richard's band? We have a 16-year-old Billy Preston.
Right.
So, I mean...
Oh, yes, they meet him, yeah.
Yeah, but they meet Little Richard. They play with Little Richard. It's amazing, all these people that they got to see and meet and play with really early on. But the shows, again, Liverpool, Birkenhead, Runcorn, Liverpool, Hull. So
whoa.
It's like, whoa. You're going to get a nosebleed if you go all the way across what becomes the M62. I don't know what it would have been at the time. You have to go over the
some
East Lancashire Road and then up some hills and down some hills. But yeah, again, we have them in Liverpool on the 28th of October with Little Richard at the Empire Theatre.
Mm.
And then we have a stop off in Hamburg again.
Oh, right.
So they're off to the Star Club. So 1st to the 14th of November, they're booked for this, and they are sticking to, partly because of Brian's influence, they're sticking to their agreements, you know.
Okay.
Can we have the Beatles back again? Yes, here they come for a fortnight. And it's the first time there with Ringo as a Beatle, obviously.
Yeah.
Obviously, they've been in Hamburg when Ringo's been there, but they're there. And again, Little Richard is there, so this is where they're spending more time with Billy Preston and Little Richard.
Mm.
And they're coming back and you're getting Coventry and Liverpool and Smethwick. So you're getting a bit of Midlands-y, you know, stuff in there. And it keeps going, it keeps going, keeps going, and gig in Wales. Then we have another recording session on the 26th of November for Please Please Me and Ask Me Why.
Okay.
Some more dates. We have the gig in Peterborough. That's one of the furthest away ones they've done for a long time. With Frank Ifield, which I've talked about before.
Right.
Where they go down like a lead balloon.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Yeah. But then they're back up to Liverpool, Southport, New Brighton, Manchester, all the same places. They're still such a local band.
Well, I guess at this point, I mean, for every number one we talk about, there's obviously hundreds, or, I mean, 99, especially if you're talking about the top 100, that didn't get to number one. A lot of them don't even, you know, aren't even getting up to those top. So it must be quite kind of you know, just standard that there's bands all over the place releasing violence. Yeah, they're not really expecting much to happen. So no one's going to chuck a load of money at them going too far afield straight away, are they?
Well, then? Also, there's lots more places to play.
Yeah.
You know, you look at the names of the types of places they're playing. It's so-and-so ballroom, so-and-so club, so-and-so corn exchange, music hall, town hall, memorial hall.
Yeah.
The baths, you know, where they put the floor over the swimming baths, yeah, and you have the swim baths. There's all these places and they have to get filled. So whether you've got a record out or not, these are the places you're going to be playing.
Yeah.
Unless you're playing the Empire Theatre because you're Little Richard, you know.
Yeah.
So that's it. But it's just amazing how they go from like this Northwest, it spreads, and then for 1963, as we'll see, you know, they are all over the country.
Yes.
All of a sudden. And yeah, but they round out the year in which they get their first, their record deal and get a record out. They round out the year in Hamburg again. So right, the fifth time in Hamburg and the last time in Hamburg. And they don't want to be there at all by this point.
Because, right,
you know, the records come out and they're missing out on all this stuff. And they're having to spend Christmas away from home.
Mm.
And so they go to Hamburg for, starting on the 18th of December and playing through till the 31st.
Right.
And they get the 24th off, which is more of a day of celebration in Germany, I'm led to believe. And there's all different stories about what they do and where they eat. There's this stuff about them going to the Siemens mission and having meat, you know, and the meat being horse.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. All that sort of stuff. But, you know, there's conflicting accounts of who was where. There's something about Paul McCartney eating a mouthful of horseradish sauce and having to sort of pretend, like politely pretend he knew what he was doing, which I hope is true because that would be a brilliant story.
Yeah.
But yeah, but that's how they round out the year, and that's their 1962 out of the way. They've got Hamburg now. That was once exciting, is now a drag.
Yeah, and a distraction.
But of course, as well, actually, in that last block of time, that's when the Star Club recordings are made.
Right.
And obviously they have never been officially released by the Beatles. Hopefully one day, you know. Hopefully. Peter Jackson's fiddling around with the tapes, so.
Okay. That's we'll good to see. Know.
But there you go. 1962, done.
So where was Love Me Do? Because we're obviously not going to talk about Love Me Do in any detail or anything because it didn't get to number one. It got to...
No, 17.
17. Is that why it peaked at 17? Did it not come back up later on?
UK, I don't think so. I haven't got the figures to hand off the top of my head, but...
So they really weren't...
I don't think there was like a retrospective boom of Love Me Do re-entering, although I will check.
Okay, so that's interesting then. Okay, that's all I wanted to know.
It's not like in America where suddenly by the time they break big in America, people are just scrambling for anything everything suddenly is in the charts.
Okay. No, that's fine. That's fine. I couldn't remember.
Okay, good.
Good. No,
I'm glad you think it's fine.
Tick, tick. Okay. No, I couldn't remember. And I'm trying to think about how big they would have been at this point. They still would be really to most people just it's banded because you know we've talked about why Love Me Do didn't rocket them up the chart straight away. In series one we talked about it. It's a bit slow. It's, it doesn't really come roaring out the gates, but it's a kind of a safe toe in the water a little bit for them, isn't it?
And it's different enough to other stuff to make it like, oh, what was that?
Yeah.
You know.
And their influence, it sounds to me from what you're telling me, is that their influence is still just starting to radiate a little bit out of their heartland, but they are still rooted in the heartland.
I mean, they are big. They are big in Liverpool.
Yes.
I mean, there's no doubting that at all. They're a huge, important group in Liverpool. But that's, as they say, a northern provincial town.
Yes, and in the UK.
Nothing came out of Liverpool.
In the UK, it was true as true then as it is now that really, you know, 90-odd percent of people of successful acts tend to have to be somewhere London based, don't they?
Yes.
To come out of the southeast, and if they're not, they're not connected to the right people and things to get themselves on the.
Yeah, it's nuts, really, but that's.
It's still the way it is because we're a small island with one big powerhouse of a city and then a completely forgotten north. No, not completely forgotten, but yeah. Anyway, enough of that. So when the Beatles were tuning in to hear themselves on the radio and, you know, or hopefully hear themselves on the radio and where they were getting in the charts, but, you know, but weren't where they wanted to be, what number ones were they hearing, Paul? Who were they thinking, darn you, I wish that was us? So we find out.
Let's do it.
Let's do it. So this week, the first up we have is Elvis Presley, She's Not You.
knows just how to make me laugh when I feel blue. She's everything man could want, but she's not you. And when we're dancing, it almost feels the same. I gotta stop myself from...
She's not you, Paul.
Am I me, Paul?
I don't know, but she's not you, Paul.
Oh, well, no one could be, really. I'm unique. A unique fact-spouting idiot, and I'll spout some facts for you now.
Do it.
Okay. Elvis Presley, She's Not You, it becomes number one on the 13th of September 1962 and spends 3 weeks at the top, which baffles me. And as we've done so much Elvis, I feel like I'm saying the same stuff over and over
Elvis
again.
Elvis fatigue.
Well, they are getting Elvis fatigue, and
but they
to
aren't.
Be honest...
The 60s people aren't, are they?
Well, perhaps not just yet, but very soon.
Ah.
Certainly in the UK. But, I mean, this gets to number five in America.
Right.
It's in the UK. It's out on RCA. The B-side is a song called Just Tell Her Jim Said Hello. It's produced by Steve Sholes with Chet Atkins and good old Bill Porter Engineering. So it's that classic Nashville studio team. Because this isn't a soundtrack session. This isn't from a film.
Yeah.
It's a song by Lieber and Stoller, who were obviously rock and roll songwriting legends, with Doc Pomus. If you want a quick Beatles connection, Doc Pomus, who we've mentioned a few times as a composer, he wrote or co-wrote Save the Last Dance for Me, which you can hear the Beatles playing in Get Back.
Okay.
They record that. And Youngblood, which obviously they cover and is on the Live at the BBC record as well. So, yeah, Elvis goes into RCA Studio B on March the 19th and 20th overnight, Monday, Tuesday, and he does a handful of songs in a way by this point where it's become so routine it's baffling, you know.
Yeah.
And yet everyone sort of historically goes, he was brilliant to work with, he knew what he wanted at this point, he, you know, except that I think... You then read a couple of other things and he very quickly starts to get bored in the studio and you count the number of takes they do for any of these things and it's like, yeah, you weren't that interested and committed.
Hmm.
Not that there's anything fundamentally wrong with this, except it's really boring.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so boring that I had a quick listen to it before you started telling me about it and I've already forgotten what it goes like.
It goes like... I never saw, and her eyes are all so blue. It starts too low for him.
Yeah.
That's what I find baffling about this. It's like he's made a decision to sort of... Because he's very good at controlling his voice at this point. And I think he's thought, well, if I do it down there, and I'm building... But he sounds like it's too low.
Very sort of weak.
It's a really weak start to the song.
Your Elvis is a bit of a ghost Elvis today.
Is it?
Yeah.
Well, Elvis is a ghost Elvis. So.
Yeah, Elvis is a ghost Elvis. That's a t-shirt. Yeah. That's a t-shirt.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's another gentle rocker that I've never heard before. I've got this theory now from all these Elvis songs that history has just decided it's just easier to kind of halve them and remember the better ones. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think most people would know this. She's not
no,
you.
I don't either. I'm not going to go out and do a pointless style poll of 100 people.
No.
We gave 100 people 100 seconds to name Elvis number ones. I don't think they're going to get a high number going, oh, she's not you.
Yeah, and I think this is the fact. When there's 30 of them, or however many there is, then you're going to have some down the bottom run where it's like it's still number one, but time has kind of shown that it wasn't one of the ones that really stood out. But anyway... I think he just had so many hits that it's just been easier to remember the best ones because it's just easier. It's just the human brain rationalizing. But you have to think at this point when we're listening to them, you know, in chronological order of hits, does this really add anything new to his legend and catalogue that we haven't heard before done better, I think? And it obviously didn't matter financially to him because it was still a hit, obviously, in the UK and enough in America. But, you know, critically, are we treading the same old ground? And at this point, I think, for this one, yeah, we are. It's got a nice rhythm and arrangement. I like the kind of very gentle reedy. Is it a sax that's kind of like barely being blown along?
Yeah, so Boots Randolph there, I think, is the sax player on it, which is sort of doing a little, joining in a little bit on the bass, walking bass pattern, isn't it?
Yeah. Now and again, not always though. Sometimes it's just lending a note. And it's very, like, must take a lot of control because sometimes you can't, it's hard enough to get any sound out of a sax, but it's kind of playing a gentle sax, which is kind of hard. As we know, it normally sax can be roaring in a motorbike and ruin songs. The piano and bass are really locked in step. That kind of sound that they've really got down to a T now by this point.
Yeah.
The little solo on the piano is quite fun. The kind of like the bouncing off the notes kind of country style kind of thing.
It's what you'd expect from Floyd Kramer.
It's Floyd Kramer of that song that we did. Fame.
Of Floyd Kramer fame.
Yeah. But it's only about 8 bars. It's a very small piano feature.
Yeah, it's a very brief piano solo.
Yeah, and Elvis himself gets to do some nice vocals on this in the kind of when we're dancing section. He kind of gets to, you know, although he...
Oh, yeah, that's where he's using his voice control. But because at that point, he's actually got up to...
His range.
His range, you know, so...
The rest is pretty standard for him. I think he takes the rest kind of in his stride a bit too much. I think that's probably what you're saying as well. It's a bit too kind of like, well, come on, Elvis, dialing it in. I'm not sure about the high backing vocals in this one.
The Jordanaires are obviously with him again, but they've also got Millie Kirkham doing, so you've got a female voice in there to add another layer on the mix.
Yeah. It feels very album tracky to me, but it got to number one, so you know I don't mind it. It's similar to the last one we did, but I think I like this one a tiny bit more than the last one when I looked at the score. So I've given it 40 for music.
Okie doke.
It's a perfectly listenable two song, but you know I just don't. I can see why collectively everyone's gone, nah, we'll just forget that one. Production. Similar story in production, though. I do like the addition of the reedy sax. Like I've said, kind of being played so gentle and very closely mic'd that you can really hear, you can hear the mouthpiece vibrating, making the sound really. But by this point, I think they could lock in the piano, bass, and guitar so tightly that they're just getting the same kind of neat sound on every recording.
Yeah, they are. They've got it down. They've got it down pat, and that's partly because they only had limited time with Elvis.
Yeah, so they've got to be ready for him to walk in and then walk out again.
Yeah, that's Elvis the Spider from Sean's show.
They
do three takes of this.
Three. Right, so you really...
Right, first take is complete, third take is complete, and the middle one's a false start. And then they record what they call work parts to splice in to try and improve the ending, but they end up not using that. They use the third take as the full take.
Okay.
But it is just by the numbers, really. There's nothing new or exciting about it. And put it this way, right? I haven't got much to add in terms of facts about Elvis at this point because we know what the pattern is. You know, make a film, occasionally do a non-film session, spend a load of money with your weird hangers-on and family. Mm. But so... they record four songs in this session. So Elvis stayed the night at the Anchor Hotel in Nashville and went into the studio from 7:30 to 2 a.m. and recorded four songs, including She's Not You. The following day, he left for L.A. in his new Dodge motorhome. So he's like, in the studio, out, off, back to L.A. now, you know.
And that's his...
In me pimped out camper van.
Three takes, and how much money do you think this quite forgettable song must have made him?
Well, and also the... Colonel Tom Parker had also got him contracts where he was going to have lots of money anyway, even beyond the royalties coming in. So
it's just a machine at this point, isn't it, really? But it's not that all the songs are bad for it, and it's not that this is a bad song. It's just that I think you can hear the machine at play with this kind of song still getting to number one because it's just self-sustaining now. It's that kind of, you could read the phone book.
And RCA would just be happy that they've got more Elvis product to put out.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. So, it's becoming a bit of an institution. Yeah, so the production-wise, it's a repeat of last week's Elvis, so I've given it exactly the same score, which was 50. It's kind of the down-the-middle Elvis. Sounds all right, sounds good, there's nothing wrong with it. It's all right by the numbers. So 50 for production. Lyrics then, Paul, lyrics. So, again, Elvis is back talking about things that aren't something else, which is a bit of a theme I'm starting to notice.
You've noticed it. Yeah,
he's just like... we need a song for Elvis where something isn't something. He's not a teddy bear, not a good luck charm. And this time,
she's not you. Something else.
She's not something else, yeah. So it's this time it's his new girlfriend that isn't his old girlfriend.
Yeah.
Basically.
He seems like a real fun date, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Because he's, you know, he's fundamentally delivering these lines to the
person that he's with now.
Yeah,
it's not what you want to hear, is it?
No, no, he's delivering the lines to his former girlfriend.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't he? That's what he's doing. But, yeah.
It's a bit awkward, isn't it? He's not winning either way there, is he? The old girlfriend.
She'd be like, Elvis, stop ringing me up. Why are you telling me this?
Stop telling me I'm not your new girlfriend. I know I'm not your new girlfriend. That's why I left you.
Yeah.
Yeah. You could just imagine him in the cinema saying, do you want to get some popcorn? Well, she used to get popcorn.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, sad date. At least it's a variation on the usual theme. A bit of complexity involving a third party. I'll give it that. I quite like the... It's just funny that it's coming... He does seem to be stuck in this rut of things that aren't things. But,
I don't know what he's got to complain about. If they're so similar, it sounds fine.
Exactly. Yeah, she's doing everything exactly the same. That makes it, it's actually a very deeply philosophical piece about identity. You know, it's a copy the same as the original, you know. 43 for lyrics I've given it, so 44 overall. Okay.
Oh, we need something different after that, Gary.
Something different. Let me see what I can pull out of the chronological, very strict, ordered bag. Let's have a look. Next we have Telstar, The Tornadoes. Telstar, Paul.
I can't make a joke out of that. Let me just get into the information.
Okay.
Okay. This gets to number one on the 4th of October, 1962. It also eventually gets to number one in America, which is...
The USA.
The US of A. It's the first US number one for a British group.
Right.
So we've all... Akabilk, who we haven't talked about on this because of the weird charts, has a solo number one with Strangers on the Shore. But this is the first British, as you'd think of a group, having a US number one. And I think one of the reasons is because it's a instrumental. Right. And it's about something that was known internationally as well, which is the Telstar satellite. But, you know, this is a really significant song. So, like I say, it spends 5 weeks at number one. It has 25 weeks in the chart overall at whatever position, which is great. It's produced by Joe Meek. It's composed by Joe Meek. It's out on Decca. The B-side is a thing called Jungle Fever, which is really quite forgettable. The thing with this to remember, this is a very well-known piece of music. It's very significant in its own way. It's by the Tornadoes, who we'll talk about, but really it's Joe Meek.
Yeah.
This is the point. Of all the productions we've had where we've mentioned Joe Meek, this is the one where he is... woven so into it that it's hard to talk about the Tornadoes as a bunch of session men, essentially. Very, very capable session men, or most of them very capable session men. But it's not really the Tornadoes' baby. They played on it. So Clem Cattini on drums, who played on Paul McCartney's Thrillington album.
Am I right? I think I'm right. And we'll establish why later. But he's someone who's drummed on the most hits of any drummer.
On the most number ones of any drummer. Yeah, amazing drummer. Yeah, he drummed on Shaken All Over as well.
Yeah.
Alan Caddy on guitar, Roger Laverne on additional keyboards, George Bellamy on rhythm guitar, and Heinz Burt. Heinz is a whole other story on bass.
He goes on to be
Joe Meek tries to make him a solo star and really kind of fails. But they record the basic track, but all the twiddly bits that you think about, the sound effects and the clavicembalo,
yes,
the actual instrument, is all added on afterwards by Joe doing the sound effects as a composer-producer. Jeff Goddard, the guy who wrote Johnny Remember Me, is playing the clavicembalo and doing the sort of wordless vocals in the last part of it. And, you know, other people helping to transcribe this. And you can actually find officially released early compositional versions of this. And also, of course, you can find the original version of the finished song, but in the at the tempo it was recorded at and in the key it was recorded at, because Joe Meeks speeds everything up
when
he releases.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So I'm interested in what you think about this, Gary, because it's so different from everything else. And I know you've been a bit critical of Joe Meeks' production.
Wow.
But this is such a odd thing.
Well, we'll have to keep with our format, and we'll have to get to production after music. But I, just to remind ourselves and our listeners, I think he has come onto our radar with Johnny Remember Me, Tanti, and without knowing anything of his story, I wasn't massively bothered about the production. But I think we established that you had to have a lot of context to be as bothered about the production on that one to realise, well, it may sound, oh yeah, it's got quite a floaty, reverby vocal. And it's only when you know that it was recorded in a flat and he was inventing a lot of that that kind of reverb and stuff that you can go, oh, whether that means that it then made a finished product that with contemporary ears without the context would sound as good as other things is a different story. And I think we'll have some of that with this one too. But I think the difference with this song is it's the very fabric of the song is very different because of the way it's been recorded and stuff, rather than it being a song with some interesting production. This is like a produced song, isn't it? So,
yeah.
But let me talk about the music in turn, and then we'll get into that a bit. Because, well, let me also say up front that you've kind of sabotaged my usual process, because you had suggested I go off and watch a film about this an entire film about this song. So whereas I normally don't do any research because that's your job, this time I've watched an entire film about it.
Yeah, I suggested you watch Telstar, the Joe Meeks story, which I'm not saying is the definitive thing. Biopics are never a definitive thing.
No.
But is an interesting way to get a kind of overview of the circumstances in which this type of music was created.
Yes.
It's not a bad film, really.
No.
And actually, if people haven't seen it, it is officially released for free on YouTube.
Oh, is it on YouTube as well?
It's on Amazon Prime, but I found that it's... that Movie Dome UK have it in full high quality on YouTube, so you can look it up there as well.
But we should also warn you, which I didn't know. You probably told me during the last one, and I forgot. I kind of vaguely had a knowledge that something bad was going to happen.
And it turns out Kevin Spacey is in it. Yes, so you have to watch out for that.
No, but there's, you know. Don't go and run off.
It's a story that ends. It ends badly.
Very, yeah. Very badly. So be careful if you are triggered by anything. But I would nicknamed it the Joe Bleak story.
Yes, which is a hilarious satirical take on the events of 1967.
Yeah, no, that's horrible. It is pretty bleak though. But you do get some very interesting context, not just to this song and the entire Joe Meek story and that of Hines and the tornadoes, but also of the surrounding kind of industry at the time. So yeah. You know, we'll talk a bit about that. Let's first though just concentrate on the song before I go into some, because I've got some questions that have come up.
All right, I've got quite a lot of answers, hopefully, but
yeah.
I've got lots of contextual information from the time.
We'll start with the music, just get that bit done. So we do really have something very different here. Not only to what we've been hearing at the time, you know, although we have had some strange instrumentals, which does seem to be quite a weird feature of the early 60s, is that every few months or so, a kind of quirky instrumental gets somewhere, doesn't it? And then
and obviously the shadows are a huge...
Yeah, the shadows are underpinning a lot of that, aren't they?
To aim for if you're a band, you know.
Yeah. But I even since then, I don't think we've heard many things like this. It didn't then create a genre... It's kind of standalone a bit, doesn't it? We start with that take-off, build-up kind of sounds. which we'll talk more about in production, because they're, and then we're in flight, I guess you'd say, with the what's it called?
So it's the clavulin. So we have featured this already because it's the instrument that plays the solo, or it's or the instrument that plays the solo on Runaway, is related to the clavulin.
Is it uncle? Isn't cousin?
Yeah, uncle clavulin.
Yeah,
but so the clavulin for us, where it's most famous, is this song, and in the Beatles, it's "Baby, You're a Rich Man."
Yes.
And it's a small 3-octave, I think, organ with a bunch of different switches and like a, it's monophonic, so you can only play one note at a time, and it has like a an expression lever that you can control with your knee.
Okay.
Because the idea was you could slide this keyboard under your organ or piano, and you know, play it alongside it, and you could use your knee to sort of control the sort of various, I presume, sort of, I don't know, because I've never played one.
A knee
clutch. I've seen one in the flesh, you know, in a museum in Germany, in Berlin.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's such a legendary, weird instrument, but it'd been around at this point, you know, a good 20-odd years.
Yeah.
Mm. Just this mad electronic noise, but...
okay.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, so, you know, that comes in with the main theme. And we'll talk, yeah, and behind that, despite everything else going on with that sound, you've got the Tornadoes, kind of pretty standard fare in the sense that we have the same drummer from Johnny Remember Me as well, doing the same kind of drums, very much that ticky 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 kind of riding, you know, the hi-hat kind of driven, kind of not very, you know, just very straightforward, kind of solid rhythm, and a bass that is literally bouncing off every chord change. It doesn't deviate at all from the way it plays. It changes chords, but it doesn't do anything beyond go ding, dung, ding, dung, you know, that kind of umpar bass line. Nothing too taxing on the Tornadoes, just following the chord progression and doing that kind of relentless pattern, putting it kind of in to modern ears, that dance music-y type of feel, you know. It's just, it's set in motion, and it's kind of like it's repeating. Then we go into the B section where we have, is it piano strings or a harp glissando or something?
Well, I don't know, because it's, you know, obviously to a quick listen, you say, oh, that's harp.
Yeah.
Like a concert harp. But I can't imagine he got a concert harpist up in the flat.
No.
In the context of this, as far as we know, to me, what it sounds like is probably a couple of people, someone operating the piano pedals and maybe holding down a chord, and then someone strumming the piano strings.
Yes, I think it sounds like piano strings.
I think that's what's more likely to be happening in the
sounds
context
very
of the
nice
way
for that, though.
Joe Meek makes music. But maybe it is a harp. I just couldn't find any evidence to say it was actually a concert harp, because I think you would know who'd played it if it was.
Yeah.
You know?
And the melody moves onto the guitar at that point. It goes to a lead guitar, doesn't it? Which has a nice
twangy guitar. That.
Yeah, it has a lovely building ambience to it as it goes along. It pretty much kind of goes verse, it's called that, well, it kind of goes A, B, A, B, A, B, doesn't it, till it ends. Mm-hmm. But we do get voices joining for the final round of the main theme. A little proto, I don't know if it's proto, actually. When did Star Trek come out? No, yeah, it was after that, wasn't it? So a little Star Trek themey kind of like, but low, not high up there.
Yeah, it's Jeff Goddard.
But is it him singing it, is it?
Yeah.
That's the guy who's wrote
playing
Johnny
Clavulin, yeah, the writer.
And then what I presume is the kind of landing or just general going off into spacey kind of outro noises again, which is the stuff. So I do like it. I think when we talk production, it'll be tricky because it's so groundbreaking, but also in other ways messy, which we'll talk about. Mm. Musically, it's an interesting progression, almost film score, kind of classical-esque in some ways, which is perhaps why the lawsuit happened that, you know, I'm sure you do want to talk about that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it,
well, that's music, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah, because it was about its similarity to a previous piece, wasn't it?
Yeah, basically, a French composer had accused Joe Meek of ripping him off.
Yeah.
Here. So,
after it became a big number one, isn't it? You know?
Yeah. So, and what happens is that the royalties, because a copyright court case is against this, royalties get frozen.
Yes.
And if you are already of a perhaps bipolar, schizophrenic, as Joe Meek clearly was,
yeah,
paranoid, you know, things like this, you know, not being able to get the money that you were due for something that's a huge smash.
I think that put a strain on anybody. You've got
the pressure of like, you put the pressure of that. And also then all the band members that you're working with, the musicians you're working with, saying, well, where's our cut? What's happening here?
Yeah.
All this sort of stuff. And this lingers on and lingers on and literally comes to a resolution after his death.
Yeah. Three weeks after his death.
Yeah, not long after his death. So it's another sort of strange and tragic part of the story.
It is. I've listened to, I think it's La Marche de Austerlitz.
Yes.
The
tune is very similar. Yeah, I mean,
it's similar, but I think, and in the end, they didn't rule that he had copied it. The film didn't come out in this country till after a couple of years after this song. Yeah. And it's unlikely he would have heard it. And it's different enough to not be like, well, he's just taking it and put it into a weird spacey thing, isn't it? To my ears, it's a bit like, well, someone's gone, hey, that sounds a bit like the thing I did, but I don't think it's enough. And if it was, it'd be extremely unconscious, I think. But it sounds coincidental to me. But whilst it is innovative, it is repetitive and basic in places, but I do like its general feel and sound. I've given it 56 for music.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about production, because this is where the meat of the conversation, isn't it? So, like I say, you know, if I'd not have known this was recorded by a pioneer in a flat, I would have thought that mostly it was a strange kind of Hammond organ sound with a bit of a farty buzz over it, along some not great sounding guitar, bass and drums, but with some interesting bits and bobs at the beginning and end. And you know how I like to reward interesting bits and bobs when I'm listening to, for me, the things with a bit of like, let's throw something mad into the production just to see what happens, always gets a bit more scores for me. So if I hadn't known all that, I would have praised the guitar lead and the strange kind of wobble tremolo it has in the B section, and also the glissando. But overall, though, I still would have thought it very muddy, and I still do think it feels very muddy in general, especially in places like, you know, when the band all do a run-up to the section, so there's a bit of a variation where it goes dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. It's very distort, that, isn't it? It does feel like the untempered force of someone who is creating and experimenting, doesn't it? It feels... raw in that sense.
It is. I think the point is he puts so much into it, and then he has a sound where literally at the end of things he compresses everything.
Yeah.
So he squishes the dynamic range so he can make it louder, which then makes the bass really push through, but not in any clarity.
Yeah.
Essentially, he treats it to a point where the individual instruments are almost indistinguishable from each other.
Yeah.
And he's only ever bothered about it coming out in mono. He's not interested in high fidelity at all.
Yeah.
Which is because it wasn't really a thing.
Yeah.
And so he wasn't sort of like doing it by a rule book like EMI does, where you can use that equipment for that and you can only use that and you must do this and have it within these levels and da 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 da. No one telling him to do that. But he's trying all sorts of things. You know, he's just got, it's an electronics laboratory as much as it's a recording studio all over his house.
Which is a flat above a shop.
Well, it's a sort of three-floor flat, isn't it? People in bathrooms, people under the stairs, people in, you know, different bits of the house to get the effects that he wants. And, again, like I say, because he wasn't bothered about the hi-fi nature of it, it's not like there's anything there to treat in the years since and sort of make it a shiny remaster. There's if you did, you'd kill this song dead.
Yeah.
You know, so basically he records the band themselves. They run off because they've got a gig. They've got to go and support someone, you know, be the backup band for someone that evening. And then he adds all this stuff on top. He also then speeds up. So I did a quick calculation with a little tempo ticker thing.
Mm.
Original version is at 135 beats per minute. The version that comes out as a single is 150 beats per minute, which pushes it up sort of almost a tone.
Yeah.
In terms of key. And gives it a bit more energy as well.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, it's just, it's full of studio tricks, but studio tricks no one else was playing because they weren't mad enough to, really. Yeah. I mean, in terms of creative madness here. And yeah, it's because he didn't bother to have limits or rules. He had a sort of way of working and just produces this as the peak of it, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah, it's just kind of creative, yeah, unrestrained creative rawness that I think is what, you know, you could kind of bring a take away from listening to this and how different it is to everything and before and since, but also therefore pioneering of things as well, as things often are when they're new and different. The fact that I now know this is the work of kind of a home-built, weird effect and sounds being pioneered by, for the first time, by, frankly, a tortured mind, shouldn't really affect my scores. But where it gains in innovation, it loses in overall clarity, basically. So yeah. Does this, for example, score better than the other big instrumental hit we've done so far of Apache for production, just because he did some funny sounds over it, and especially at the beginning and end? I mean, when you take a step back from all that, I think it about evens out. Where it makes up in innovate, where it gains in innovation, it loses in that overall. And that, I think that's fair from what you've just said as well. I gave it 58 for production, and there's no lyrics, so that gives it 57 overall. But that doesn't mean I want to stop talking about it because I want to.
Well, no, I've got loads of other stuff here as well. Because what we haven't actually talked about is what Telstar is.
Yes, so
because if you don't know, you don't know. You know, it's Telstar not relevant today.
I know what Telstar is.
Yeah, so Telstar is a communications satellite.
Yeah,
and it's launched on the 10th of July 1962, a collaboration between Britain and America and France. And Telstar is the thing that first allows this around-the-world communication without cables. You know, it's beamed up to the Telstar orbiter, which then pings it back down. Now, the bizarre thing about Telstar and Telstar 2, which goes up in 1963, because this is fairly sort of test equipment as much as anything, is they're in an elliptical orbit. Now, this has got nothing to do with the song.
No.
But, of course, if you're in an elliptical orbit, it means at different times of your orbit of the planet, you are further away than at other times, which means you can't have a reliable system of, like, always being able to broadcast.
Right.
And get the signal to do the same thing at all points on the orbit, essentially.
Okay.
So later satellites that are used are geostationary, which means they remain the same distance relative, you know, to the position on the Earth.
Mm.
I mean, that's my science lesson for the day. And I'm sure a lot of people will be shouting at it, going, that's not exactly how it works. But
I think that is how geostationary orbits work, isn't it?
Well, yeah. So basically, by the time we get to the Our World broadcast in 1967, you know, the Beatles, All You Need Is Love, that's using a different set of satellites.
Yeah.
But Telstar was the first big, like, international wow. And you can still see the footage now of them watching, like, and we're going to see, and yes, we're going over to Goonhilly Downs.
Ah, yes.
And yes, and that's definitely a man's face. And the newspapers at the time, like 1st of February 1962, obviously before it's launched, is like, the headline is, Daily Sputnik TV from America this summer. Live television programs beamed from America will be screened daily in Britain this summer, is their claim, you know, in this paper.
I take it that didn't happen because...
Well, no, it didn't really, because... Yeah. It wasn't reliable enough for that.
No.
And but it's a good predictor of things to come.
Yes.
Really, conceptually.
Yeah.
And obviously the word Sputnik they've used in there is because the Russians have their Sputnik satellite up already.
Yeah,
and this is...
They were the first to get one up.
Yeah. But it's so Sputnik's just become a sort of catch-all term for a communications satellite at this point. But it's very inspirational, and that's where you get that rocket takeoff sort of effect at the start and the sort of spacey feel in the tune as well. I must mention as well, a little while later, he produced a vocal version of the song.
Oh, I've read something about that, yeah.
By Kenny Hollywood is the name given to the artist on this, and the song's called Magic Star, and it is abysmal.
Right.
Oh, it's bad.
Hmm. Yeah, I feel like I should go and listen to it. I take it it didn't do anything.
No.
No. I have two questions.
Go on.
Probably more, but these are the two that I... One, where's Telstar now? Go on, tell me that. Is it still in space or has it come down?
Both Telstars, I think Telstar 1 and 2, are still orbiting, obviously not working.
That's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
Especially seeing as I think space junk does come down eventually. You know,
don't, some does, yeah, but apparently
decay or eventually or.
But no, maybe the elliptical orbits don't. Maybe that's
who
it.
Knows.
Maybe we have to dodge Telstar every time we try and leave the planet.
It's crazy, really, to think that that's still just spinning around up there.
Yeah.
Two, there's a scene in the film where he says, "Oh, Brian's got this beat combo, Mersey beat combo, and he wants me to listen to. Bless him, he's a lovely guy, but you don't know what the kids want."
That's very good.
Yeah. Does that happen, or is that just them doing a bit of artistic license, or could Joe Meek have ended, was Epstein basically reaching out to everybody, and Joe Meek might have been one of the people who had a tape and put it in the bin?
Right. Okay. So, I think this is a rumour that Joe Meek himself later sort of encouraged a little bit, or people involved with him certainly seemed to, that when Brian was looking for a record company for the Beatles, he approached all sorts of people, one of whom was Joe Meek.
Mm.
You know, and some people say, oh, he wined and dined him a bit, and others say he just sent him a tape and stuff like that. It's almost certainly that he didn't.
Okay.
Because Joe Meek wasn't a record company. He was an independent record producer.
Yeah.
And even if he'd have got him to record the Beatles, there'd be no guarantee that they would be released.
Yes.
So it's very unlikely from most scholarship now, I think, that Joe Meek did not have this sort of like, oh, Brian sent me a tape. But his music isn't like Merseybeat at all, or any of what's coming next, which is interesting. You know, we'll hear some of his attempts to do beat music.
Yeah.
Oh,
will we?
Yeah. And which is interesting. But as we've said, complicated man, paranoid. As his success doesn't play out the way he wants it to, he starts to, you know, be convinced people are bugging his house and like that.
Yeah,
he does get arrested for cottaging, and he's convinced that he's going to be blackmailed and by, you know, mobsters, you know, London mobsters and things like that. It's a really quite a tragic story.
It's very tragic. It's very
and it's not helped by the fact that he was surrounded by people like Jeff Goddard, who encouraged his interest in spiritualism and the seances and going out to graveyards to record cats meowing that he thought was it communicating from the other side. All this stuff that is just paints a really unusual picture of a person. And of course, what we're doing is we're talking about Joe Meek, and we're not talking about the Tornadoes at all, because really,
there's not much to say on this. Aren't they?
You know, I found a fair bit of like coverage of them at the time. They have the hit with Telstar, so Larry Parnes signs them as an act in their own right, rather than just the backing band for Billy Fury or whatever. The Tornadoes' hit disc of Telstar is to be released in America on the London label, which is something from the 22nd of September 1962, and as we know, it goes on to be number one, which is amazing. I found an article called "The Tornadoes' Story is Plain Crazy, and They Admit It." And you can see them like doing the miming to this for various shows at the time. And you don't see the clavier. Obviously, the Roger Laverne, who's playing the piano, is just playing an organ. So, their image and the image of Telstar and that song is bound together. But really, it's the story of Joe Meek.
Yeah. Okay. One thing I just want to say, though, is thank goodness that one, that the Epstein probably never did actually reach out to him. And two, if he had a done, that Joe Meek didn't take them on, because can you imagine anything less conducive to the getting the Beatles we ended up getting than them having been stabled with Joe Meek?
No,
that would
exactly,
have been terrible. Because he would have suffocated them too early on with his what he was doing. Like, you know, they wouldn't have been able to become who they were. So thank goodness that didn't happen. Not to say that he didn't have a place, but that wouldn't have been his place anyway with them. So anyway, we have to move on. You could do so much on the tornado as well, you know, on Telstar specifically and Joe Meek. I would say if you watch the film, do be wary, and perhaps if just check that you understand where the story ends, which I won't tell you here, but it's not a pleasant place. You have to know about that. But it is very interesting at the same time. Shall we move on then, Paul?
Yes. I think we need something different again after that.
Let's see what we've got. Frank Ifield, Lovesick Blues.
I got a feeling called a blue, losing for baby said goodbye. And I don't know what I'll do. All I do is sit and cry. Oh, oh Lord, that last long day she said goodbye. Lordy, well, I thought I'm gonna cry. She'd do me, she'd do you, she'd got the kind of loving. Lord, I'd love to hear her when she called me sweet baby. Such a beautiful dream. I hate to think it's all.
Lovesick Blues, Paul.
Hate well read, Gary. Is that the opposite? I don't know.
Love, sick, hate, well.
Reds.
Reds. Oh, very good.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm just tired after talking about Telstar. Okay, Love, Sick, Blues. Frank Ifield's back. And this time he's yodeling. Because he didn't really yodel very much in...
No, it was very...
I Remember You.
Light yodeling, if any.
So the yodeling has upped in this one, but not massively, but certainly compared to the B-side, which is She Taught Me How to Yodel, which is yodel-tastic all the way through. It's obviously, it's another Norrie Paramore production, composed by Irving Mills and Cliff Friend in 1922, this song. It gets to number one on the 8th of November 1962 and spends 5 weeks there. Frank is doing well.
Yeah. He's only just come out the chart and he's back in again.
Exactly. So, like I say, originally written in 1922, there's some talk of it having featured in a musical at the time called Oh, Ernest, which was a musical adaptation of Oscar Wilde's Importance of Being Earnest.
Right.
Although I ended up in a research rabbit hole and I couldn't find any evidence that this song was featured in that show at all. But it was recorded a lot at the time. It was very popular. And it's recorded by sort of country and Western superstar Hank Williams. Mm-hmm. In 1949, Hank Williams and his Drifting Cowboys, which I think is a brilliant name for a backing band. I just have this image of these cowboys trying to ride their horses and just keep going sideways.
Yeah, or on stage, they just keep them wandering off the sides to the wings and people have to kind of
push them back on again.
Yeah.
But yeah, Hank Williams is, some of his recordings are amazing and he was very big and very influential. And so it's one of those songs that's been around a long time. And if you want a good Beatles link here, what we've talked about already with Frank Ifield. So if you go to this, look at the stage, 18th of October 1962, there's a little advert in there that says, Wright hits, a smash hit, Lovesick Blues, recorded by Frank Ifield on Columbia. Lawrence Wright Music Company, Denmark Street, London. That Denmark Street's where all the publishers were.
Mm.
The Lawrence Wright Music Company had the copyright in the UK, at least, for lots of these really classic old songs that loads of people knew, standards, you'd call them, of which this is one. Lawrence Wright, the publisher himself, dies in 1964. And after a few years, the song catalogue is bought by Dick James for Northern Songs.
Ah,
and it becomes part of the Beatles. The Beatles own this song by after buying it for £812,500 on the 31st of December 1968.
Not just this song, the catalogue.
Well, the Lawrence Wright music catalogue.
Yeah, that'd be a
lot. So Dick James's plan was, you know, Northern Songs isn't just Lennon McCartney. We can use it to buy up all this other stuff.
Yeah.
Which he does just before they all fall out and lose their publishing catalogue. So,
well, there you go.
So there's a little Beatles link.
Easy come, easy go. Yeah. So Frank Ifield, he's a handsome chap, isn't he?
He's all right.
Yeah. I was just reminding myself of the song and thought he's a handsome chap on the picture that was on. Was he the one who had something to do with Paul McCartney's girlfriend?
Yeah.
That's why I was thinking about it. Anyway, this is jolly jolly, isn't it? Kind of yodel-y blues pop. I mean, it has the word blues in the title, but it's one of the chirpiest blues songs in the world, if it is blues.
Yeah.
It's blues by the virtue of, they says the word blues in it, but it's from the off we have these chirpy little horns doing their own kind of semitone yodel. Yeah, they're going to, like, they're doing their little yodel. They're almost like yodeling, but in horn form, and then shuffling along, we have a kit and guitar and bass kind of going at pace along with him. I'm using the word shuffling a lot in 1962. I think the word shuffle is quite prominent. If you were to do a word cloud of this year, I think shuffle would be one of them. Bands seem to shuffle. Do you know what I mean? They don't seem to attack. They seem to shuffle in the background a bit. I think there's a propensity towards that gentle but driven, almost jazzy backing combo feel going on at this time.
Well, think about how many bands we've heard that are under the watchful baton of Norrie Paramore.
Yes, so. I, and if you've got a well-controlled and environment for recording hits where you want the vocalist to be, you want a band that are like with Elvis, you want a band that are just tight and going to shuffle along and aren't going to cause any problems, are you, in the chain, kind of in the recording chain. I like the additional, the addition even, of the vibraphone that rings out nice and satisfyingly.
Yeah, yeah.
I like a vibraphone. It's a very
it's good.
Pure sound, isn't it? And it's a good sound to go along with his yodely vocal. And it is a mad yodely vocal. Let's
yodely
be honest.
Vocal.
I really like his voice. And it's just, this is as much yodel as I want in my pop, I think.
You've hit the yodel sweet spot.
Yeah. Beyond this, it would be a yodel too far.
you sounded like you were yodeling saying that.
Yodel has is kind of
automatic peer.
Onomatopoeic, isn't it? Yodel. It's got it in there. It's used for interest and it's his USP, isn't it? I don't know how bad it gets, but it doesn't sacrifice the song and melody that he's doing his kind of throat singing the way he does. He does blend the bluesy rock and roll elements with the alpine yodeling quite well.
Yeah.
Something that not many people, I suppose, have had to do before. I like it. It's fun. I quite like it.
There's a tradition of the yodel being part of country music. And
yes, of course.
You know,
is,
you can do all sorts of tracing back of where the influences come from through sort of...
settlers.
Immigration settlers, all that sort of stuff. And the folding in of different folk musics and stuff like that. But yeah, clearly what they've got with Frank is they know that he can do it and he can do it really well. Like I say, the B-side of this is a song called She Taught Me How to Yodel, and he is yodeling full tilt.
Yeah, so I haven't really listened to that. That I should do.
And I think that could have been a hit itself, but it would have been a novelty hit.
So funny enough, when I was talking to Mum about this week's songs, and I said, oh, it's a Frank Highfield one. I was trying to remember what it was. She said, she taught me how to yodel? So that was obviously known enough.
Yeah, yeah.
For Mum to know about a B-side.
I think it was one he would do like on TV shows and things like that, because it's a bit of a quite a flashy vocal thing to do, really.
Yes. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, I say it. I think it's fun, and I quite like his voice. I quite like that Frank Highfield stuff we've had so far. 48 for music. So production, though, having just spent some time with Telstar, that makes this, you realise that clarity, you know, of a Norrie Paramore.
Of what you get
production.
Out of Abbey Road.
Yes.
Yeah.
And why, you know, maybe he was going against the mainstream in other ways. There's this sounds crystal clear having just spent time with Telstar. It's all recorded really well and cleanly. And the horns sit in the mix great, as does the vibraphone. And the, like I said, the band feel really connected to each other and all at a good level, that are just inhabiting the same space in the audio mix, allowing his feature vocal to be just that.
Yeah.
It kind of all is quite neatly compartmentalised. This is the band over here. You've got added little bits here. You've got the voice bang right there. I think it's very proficient, really. I don't have much else to say about it. Maybe not innovative, but
no,
what was needed
no.
for this to be what it is. So I give it 51 for production.
Oh, right. Okay. It's classic. It's just exactly what you've said. That's essentially what my notes say. I will say, if anyone wants to listen to a slightly different version that's not Hank Williams or Frank Highfield, Glenn Campbell, who I love, does a version of this on a record in 1974, and it's great because it's Glenn Campbell. So
yeah.
Look that one up.
Okay. So lyrics then. Again, not much to say about these lyrics. It helps that he uses words like blues and do, because that gives him that vowel sound he needs to jump off of. To do that kind of yodel singing, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's...
it's got a weird... scansion, is that the word I'm looking for?
Scansion.
Like sections that Lord love to hear when she calls me sweet baby, but the baby's the end word of one line, but it's the sort of start of a new phrase. Swallows me sweet baby. I can't do the yodeling. Such a beautiful dream is the start of the next block, but it feels like you're halfway through something else already.
Yeah,
it's, the way the word rhythms fall and the melody patterns fall.
Lord love to hear when she called me sweet baby, comma. Such a beautiful dream. I hate to think it's all. Oh, that's basically it. It's got the word sugar daddy in it, which is it's always a bit strange. It's mainly what it says it is, a song about being lovesick because his lady said goodbye and he can no longer be a sugar daddy.
It's very repetitive. There's not much to it, is there?
But it rambles along. 38 for lyrics, 45 overall.
There you go, Frank.
Frankie. So finally, what can we get that's a bit different again from quite a mixed bag this week? Let's have a look for the last song of 1962. It is Elvis again. Return to Sender.
I gave a letter to the postman. He put it in his sack. Bright and early next morning, he brought my letter back. She wrote upon it, return to sender, address unknown, no such number, no such song.
Return to sender, Paul.
What do I look like? The post office?
The post office.
Yeah.
Not a postman. The post office.
I could have said postman, didn't I?
Do I look like the institution that is the post office?
The crumbling institution that is the British post office.
Yeah.
Anyway, return to sender. Oh, finally, an Elvis we know.
Yes. Yeah.
But also sounds quite a lot like the first one we listened to when you actually think about it.
Well, but this is one of the ones that survives.
This one will stay in your head.
Yeah.
So this is number one on the 13th of December 1962. Spends 3 weeks there, so that's Christmas number one. It's a soundtrack session, this one. So this is from a film. This is from the film Girls, 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 which is not a good film. I'll give you a quick summary of the film as taken from everyone's favourite encyclopedia, Wikipedia.
Mm-hmm.
He plays a guy called Ross. Ross is caught in a love triangle with two women, an insensitive club singer and a sweet person called Laurel. When someone else makes advances on Laurel, Ross punches him out. Wes owns a boat, so Ross thereby loses it. Ross wants this boat. He's a fisherman. Flipping heck. This isn't a very good description. Laurel, however, is not who she pretends to be. She is an heiress getting over a bad breakup and searching for someone who doesn't love her for her money. She secretly buys the West Wind, the boat, for him, but Ross's male pride won't allow him to take it. Ross has to choose between her and Robin. It's set in Hawaii. He's another beach bum.
Right.
He was doing a Hawaii job, in this case, I think a fisherman or something.
Right.
Oh, yeah, he's a Hawaii-based fishing guide, and he wants to buy a boat. And the film's called Girls, Girls, Girls.
That'll
and the
sequence, do.
He sings this in a nightclub scene, and it's like he sort of looks like he's laughing at himself doing it. Like, wouldn't you to have another take and say, Elvis, can you try and remember you're in character here?
Yeah,
because he does look like he can tell that this is crap going on around him. But it's a good. It's one of the better songs.
Yeah.
Written by Winfield Scott and Otis Blackwell on RCA. It's obviously a hit in America. It's number two. So for a soundtrack song, not that these have all been bad, the soundtrack songs, but this is one of the better ones from one of the worst films.
Yeah, it's the opposite of what normally happens, isn't it? I think the soundtrack. Well, no, the rock and roll ones have been is kind of in betweeny ones. I've liked some of the soundtrack songs when they've been good songs, but they've been the more kind of based on the 17th century classic or other.
Yeah.
And these rock and roll ones have been more kind of just written for him to knock out some hits.
I think in this case, this wasn't written as part of the block of soundtrack stuff, but he heard it and liked it. And
yes,
and in an odd move, the Colonel went, "Oh right, okay, yeah, that'll go in the movie."
Yeah,
because the Colonel would normally be like, "No, those are the things for that." And so I think that gives it something a bit different, with the fact that it doesn't come from the sort of just big writing session of whatever. Pulling this stuff together.
No, I'm glad that we've got a classic back, and it's not a one of these derivative kind of hits that were hits because he was Elvis, but haven't stood the test of time. This one has, I think. I'm doing that thing that politicians do of just saying, because this is my reality, it's everyone else. But I think, I feel like probably a lot of people will know Return to Sender more than they know the one we talked about earlier.
More people will know Return to Sender than will have seen Girls, Girls, Girls.
Yes. And this really does feel like it could have come at any point in his career. And I'm surprised to see it was one that came out of his kind of film kind of period and from a film. To a point where I had to go and check that this was an original version, and I wasn't thinking of an earlier number done by someone that,
I understand what you mean. Earlier. I understand.
It's got a bit of energy. It's got a really great melody and backing bass line that the horns join in on the chorus when they're not doing fun little motifs. I like how he's singing it with a kind of clipped vocal style to emphasise the theme, the kind of abrupt declaration. It's going to return to sender. You know what I mean? It's very he's performing it in a way that's to suit the song. It's only short, it's quick, it's pacey, so it feels precise and neat. The backing vocals and Elvis, as usual, are locked in very well. And we get that fun, she rode upon it bit, which everyone can belt out if you're singing along to it, which links you into the chorus, which is memorable. So, yeah, I think it's got classic rock and roll written all over it. I've given it 56 for music. It's still not anything. It's not anything new.
No,
but it's a very good example of what he can do.
It's got some nice bongos in the mix in a really weird way.
Oh,
it's like I was like, what's that percussion sound? Because one of them sounds like a really loose skinned bongo, but it's like it's way back in the mix. At first, I was thinking, is that a recording error? And then it's like suddenly, it's sort of if you listen carefully, there is little sneaky bongos in there.
Sneaky bongos, but they're so sneaky they snuck past me.
Yeah.
Sneaky Bongos.
That could be the name of someone who played on it.
Sneaky Bongos.
Yeah.
Sneaky Bongos Martin.
Yeah.
Bongos would be in inverted commas.
Well, I mean, this is a record that features Hilmer J. Tiny Timbrell on guitar. So Tiny Timbrell, Boots Randolph, and Sneaky Bongos.
What was the little mouse called that used to be that went with them as well?
Oh, I don't know. Was Tiny Timbrell the mouse?
I can't remember. I'm sure we came up with a little mouse that lives in the pocket of one of the backing singers.
Counselor Mouse, yeah.
Production. I mean, they've got the Elvis sound down now again, haven't they?
Even though this is a film Hollywood.
One. Yeah. This time we have a horn playing along the kind of fully voiced rather than like the last one with the sax, but it just joins the shuffly band again. We're in Shuffle Town. I'm not going to spend time repeating myself about Elvis's production because I think we get the gist now, and I don't think this one breaks the mold particularly.
No, it's this. By the way, this is produced by Joseph Lilley and engineered by Thorn Noga, as the soundtrack sessions tended to be.
Ah, well, I think they did a very good job. And I liked it slightly more than the last one, so I've given it 54 for production. Is that a little bit more?
Okay, how many takes do you think they did to get this down?
I think they took 5 takes.
Okay, I'll give you one more guess.
I think they took 4 takes.
They took 2 takes.
Oh, I was getting closer. 2 takes. Yeah. But you don't know how long he's practiced it, though, do you?
He hasn't practiced it at all. They go through them a bit. He chooses them or he hears them in advance.
But yeah, he could have spent all night in his room singing it to a record, to an acetate or something from... Or something.
He didn't practice.
All right.
He did this all in the studio. But he had all those people with him that he knew he could rely on, the drummers and the guitarists and stuff like that, so they could work the stuff up really quickly.
Excellent. I haven't watched the Elvis biopic that was out recently.
Yeah, I talked about that, didn't I, ages ago.
I want to watch it.
When I started doing my impression of... my impression of Paul F. Tompkins doing an impression of Colonel Tom Parker.
Right. I'll give it 54 production, I've said that already. Lyrics then. We finally have an Elvis song that's not about not being a thing. Or have we? Because you know what isn't a thing in this song?
I don't know.
The address.
No such number, no such zone.
Yeah, so actually, Elvis and his existentialism is back again. You know, the address on the letter doesn't exist.
I like the idea that Elvis is just writing letters and he's putting them in an envelope, and on the front he's just writing, my girlfriend, and putting them in a postbox and wondering why they keep coming back to him.
I like how your my girlfriend was a good Elvis impression, but had a little bit of a northern twang. My girlfriend.
Hey, my girlfriend.
My girlfriend. Oh, my girlfriend.
Mother, it's come back again, says return to sender on it.
Return to sender.
Sender.
No, but this is post Mr. Postman, so his writers aren't the first to come up with the letter motif in a song.
Oh, I mean, that sort of thing's been around for as long as popular songs been around.
But I like how on the first attempt, he presumes that just the basic mail service is just poor, so he sends it special delivery the second attempt. So the first attempt went, no.
Special D.
Yeah, so the first attempt they kind of send back, go, no, that address just doesn't exist. And he's like, oh, I'll try someone else. Maybe they'll make the address exist. And then this means that if you think it through, the implication is that either his lover previously lied to him about where she lives, or she has moved. But even if she's moved, also the whole building has been demolished.
Well, I mean, it's one thing. So you could, if you knew it was from someone you didn't want to reply to, you could just scroll it through and say, not known at this address.
So she's the one putting return to sender on it. Oh my goodness.
Except it says no such number, no such zone, which suggests that the entire postal zone doesn't exist. Yeah. So this is before zip codes. This is a year before zip codes come in America.
Oh, that would have changed the whole story altogether then, wouldn't it?
Yeah. So they have postal zones, which is why the word zone's in there, you see. But yeah, that would be the post office doing that. So he's clearly miswriting it.
Yeah, this is the thing. It doesn't make sense that you sent it more than once. Yes, sorry, Mr. Presley. We cannot deliver to the address. My girlfriend. we never find out what happens. We never find out what happens the next day when he tries to deliver it himself.
No.
Because the logic doesn't work out, because it ends with him saying, the next time I'm going to take it myself and put it right in her hand. And if it comes back the very next day, then I'll understand. So, I understand if he gives it to his girlfriend in this imaginary address and then the next goes home and then the next day it says return to send. It's definitely her doing it then, isn't it? It doesn't really follow through when you
Do you think Special D is like Special K?
It was a proto version. It was one of the prototypes. They had to get through it.
Eight versions
of it before they landed on the tasteless.
Another reason your post hasn't arrived, Elvis, is you keep putting it in cereal instead of a postbox.
Yeah, you keep putting it in bland cereal. If you don't have Special K in your country, it's bland cereal. Okay. I still think it's still a classic idea, though, isn't it? Return to sender.
It's fine. I mean, it's. It's not. It's in the tradition of I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Yes.
Type thing. You know, these, like I say, these songs have been around a long time. Except this one doesn't have the phrase "kisses on the bottom" in it. So,
I've given it 45 for lyrics because I think it's memorable. 53 altogether, and that's that.
Okay.
And that's that. That's 1962. Done.
Yeah. Long episode. Sorry, everyone.
Yeah, it's Telstar's
fault. I'm not sorry. I don't care.
It's not like we get paid by the minute, Paul. Or by anything.
No, true.
So, right. So let's look at the non-charters then. So Elvis Presley, She's Not You at number 34. I say non-charters, non-top 20. Not only coming at number 34. And Frank Ifield, Lovesick Blues at number 29. So even though I liked it, I think we're getting to that point where you've got to be quite special now to jump into that top 20 now, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And this leaves us with the new top 20 with two additions to it, so I will go through that now. At number 20, Michael Holiday, Starry Eyed. At number 19, Helen Shapiro, Walking Back to Happiness. At number 18, Poetry in Motion, Johnny Tillotson. At number 17, Elvis Presley, Are You Lonesome Tonight. At number 16, Elvis Presley, Return to Sender. At number 15, Michael, The Highwayman. At number 14, Bee Bumble and the Stingers, Nut Rocker. At number 13, Elvis Presley, It's Now or Never. At number 12, Surrender, Elvis Presley. At number 11, The Everly Brothers, Walk Right Back. At number 10, Ray Charles, I Can't Stop Loving You. At number 9, The Tornadoes, Telstar. At number 8, Marie's The Name, His Latest Flame, Elvis Presley. At number 7, The Shadows, Wonderful Land. At number 6, The Everly Brothers, Kathy's Clown. At number 5, Roy Orbison, Only the Lonely. At number 4, Shaking All Over, Johnny Kidd and the Pirates. At number 3, Danny Williams, Moon River. At number 2, The Shadows, Apache. And at number 1, Del Shannon and Runaway. Happy with that.
There we are.
That'll do. Is that a couple of years done, Paul?
And it's going to be interesting to see what changes now. I'm really excited about 1963. I'm very excited about getting to 1964. Oh, it's going to be good.
Great stuff. Well, we shall see you in 1963. See you next week.
Bye-bye. Bye, Beatles. Good Beatles?